Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the December 6, 2016 House Interim Committee on Energy and Environment. Welcome. So we've got a lot of really good reports today on things that we have passed in this committee, studies that we've asked for. And so this is, I see this as kind of my wrapping up of my term as chair and getting some reports on all the things that we've done. But we're actually going to start out today with the work session to introduce the legislative concepts so that they can be pre-session filed in preparation for the 2017 session. And just as a reminder, we're just voting on this to get them into the system so that they can become bills and start going through the process. Voting on these does not mean that you support or do not support the concepts. It's really just administrative at this point. So with that, I'm going to open a work session.
Chair Vega Peterson, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills, LC 2258, dates 11-17-16. LC 2512, dated 9-29-16, LC 2911, dated 11-7-16, LC 2924, dated 11-21-16, LC 3009, dated 11-30-16, LC 2948, dated 11-8-16, and LC 2947, dated 12-13-16.
Representative Johnson moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills, LC 2258, dated 11-17-16, LC 2512, dated 9-29-16, LC 2911, dated 11-7-16, LC 2924, dated 11-21-16, LC 3009, dated 11-30-16, LC 2948, dated 11-8-16, and LC 2947, dated 12-13-16. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Johnson.
Briefly, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. if I may, and this conversation has come up in other committees over the preceding day or two, but it does seem a little odd that this legislature is introducing committee bills for the incoming legislature that isn't effectively here yet. And I do understand that House rules allow for this, but there may be some changes or may want to be some changes in House rules going forth for the next legislature so that, in fact, the organizational days in January are for this type of purpose rather than the December. All hubris here right now, but we'll continue on. Thank you.
Yes, I appreciate that, Representative Johnson, and I understand that's come up in other committees, and I think that for the process of making sure that the clerk's office has, you know, a chance to get everything in the system, they prefer us to do it this way, but I think that'll be a discussion that we'll have. Not me, though. Okay. Any other comments for discussion on the LCs? All right. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. All right. And I'm going to open an informational meeting. And first up will be the progress on the energy storage report from PUC. This is related to House Bill 2193 from the 2015 session, and we have Jason Eisdorfer. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here.
Good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Program Director at the Public Utility Commission. So we're going to have a couple. We're going to appear twice in a row in front of you. The first is to talk about the energy storage bill, HB 2193, and how the commission is implementing that. And then I'm going to have Julie Peacock from PUC staff also come up, and we're going to go through the 1547 implementation at the commission. So first of all, here we go. If I can do that. 2193 was passed in 2015, and what I'm going to do here is just to go over really quickly what I'm going to talk about, remind everybody what the requirements are in that bill, talk about our process, and then talk about what we've learned to date. 2193 requirements. The ultimate objective of 2193 was to have the utilities propose a certain amount of energy storage capacity on their systems, and if appropriate, the PUC is then authorized to approve those projects. Ultimately, it's a deeper intent, and that intent is to have both utilities and my staff understand the values and costs of storage on the system, and also the stakeholders as well. So through this process, we are learning a lot, and I'll talk about that at the end. It is a developing resource, and the law gives the PUC some wiggle room at the end in terms of balancing the costs and benefits to the ratepayer in order to gain experience and move forward with certain storage projects. The law says that the storage systems under this process won't exceed 1% of peak load. That's 5 megawatts hours of energy when you look at the PGE and PacifiCorp loads in 2014. Only California and Oregon in throughout the country have mandated storage targets. California jumped in with both feet, and they were looking actually to up their targets to 1.2 gigawatts. I think we're smart to move forward. Storage is potentially a significant resource, but I think we can stay a little bit on the sidelines and watch California do what they're going to do. We can learn from what they're doing right and potentially what they're doing wrong. I think Massachusetts is the only other state that has really begun to look at storage as a mandate. So I truly hope that this is the most boring PowerPoint photo you will see all next session. It is, although it's actually pretty exciting. This is PGE's Salem Smart Power Project. This is what 5 megawatt hours looks like. So just to give you a sense of what, this is one form of storage. And I'll come back to that in a little bit. The process was in two phases. The commission was required to adopt guidelines by the end of this month. And these guidelines are providing the utilities direction on how to make their project proposal submissions. And then in phase two, PacifiCorp and PGE are ultimately required to make those proposals by the end of 2018. And during that period of time, throughout next year, we're looking to examine a number of potential values off of storage. For example, deferred investment in generation transmission and distribution infrastructure, reducing the need for adding peak demand generation capacity, improving renewable integration, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and improving transmission or distribution system reliability. The law sets out the process by which the utilities bring forward these proposals, and again, the commission is allowed to sort of reasonably balance the value of customers investing in these projects. So this looks like a busy slide, but actually makes a lot of sense. The horizontal axis is the discharge, the amount that can be discharged from the storage. The vertical axis is over what period of time. And then it's populated with a number of different kind of storage technologies. So if you go to the upper right, you can see the pumped hydro or the compressed air energy storage. These can be very large systems, also potentially very costly systems, but they can discharge a lot of energy over a long period of time. And they can be used for things like bulk integration of renewable resources and arbitraging market prices. So the hydro pen can fill during low cost, low load hours, and then arbitrage that by selling the output in high load, high cost hours. On the other hand, in the lower left are flywheels or nickel metal hydride batteries. These are smaller energy sources. They discharge over a smaller amount of energy over a shorter amount of time, and can be used for things like frequency regulation and instantaneous balancing of the system. So this graphic is really showing the variety of technologies can be used to solve a variety of different kinds of problems. This is a similar kind of graphic. It shows on the left the benefits to the system: economic dispatch, grid balancing, renewable integration, asset optimization, and then the different kinds of benefits you can find given the duration of the output of those storage facilities. So ultimately, we'll get to it in a second, but really I'll say it here, that what's really necessary is to understand what the system needs are and the values of the various technologies, and then to marry the right technology with the right need. And that sounds sort of obvious, but I think at this stage in the development of storage and our existing distribution system, that's something that we continue to need to investigate. So a very short little example on the benefits side. Imagine the smart power, the PGE storage system that we saw a little bit earlier, and it's a substation sited distribution storage facility. And start looking at what benefits can emerge from that. So balancing, that's better balancing the instantaneous load and generation. Improving system reliability, that's taking care of small-scale disruptions in the energy supply. Deferring substation equipment upgrades by shaving peak system peak demand. So if you can lower the peak demand and delay additional distribution system investment, that is a good thing. If an investment is a 20-year life and you are able to invest in it 5 years later, that's a good thing. And who knows, within those 5 years, some other dynamic may have occurred so that you may not even have to make that investment at all, or a less expensive investment. And then finally, the variable resource integration, which would be modest but real at this substation level. And then on the cost side, the main costs are the battery itself and the lifespan of the battery, so the number of times and the ability to charge and discharge, what the finite life there may be associated with that, and then the cost of the electricity to charge the battery. So this is really a exercise of adding up the benefits and the costs of storage and understanding those values. Lessons learned so far. Again, this is that first bullet is sort of the obvious one. It's sort of easy to say that the values depend upon the grid location, the technology, and how it's used. But therein lies, I think, the challenge. These are new technologies. There's a variety of technologies. We're trying to figure out where on the distribution system they work best. And so that is causing us to look at a variety of case studies to identify what benefits can be addressed by which storage technology. Second bullet is energy storage is both optimizing the existing system and potentially deferring additional investment. And then the third one is sort of outside of the box of this particular proceeding. The commission is currently engaged in a resource value of solar docket, which also has locational value elements to it. In addition, we've begun talking to the utilities about distribution system planning, which is a pretty in-depth look at their distribution system, even at the substation level, and trying to understand what challenges there are and how best to meet those challenges. So the lessons that we've learned so far are about storage itself, but is also helping us in some of our other dockets. And then finally, our next steps, the guidelines are due out at the end of the month. I can tell you on a firsthand basis that it's only a few days away before this goes out. Two years ago, we went up to visit the Pacific Northwest National Lab, where they've been doing a lot of really good analysis on storage, developed a relationship with them, and have secured their assistance just on some of the analytical elements in our process. And frankly, some of this is going to be new to my commission's the staff. And so getting help from the National Lab is going to be important. And then finally, PG&E and PacifiCorp will develop the evaluations, which will assess those potential benefits in about 6 months, and then 6 months later, they will make their project proposals. So there it is.
Thank you very much, Jason. And I know that we've actually, Beth and I have worked, I think I'm getting the Pacific Northwest National Labs down here, and we just were never able to do it for scheduling, so it made that something for the future. Now, this session. Any questions for Jason on energy storage? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Jason, do you have a budget for what this exercise is going to cost PUC and also the IOUs?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz, no, we just, this is just a docket that we would normally open, so staff time is what it is. The National Lab is helping us out pro bono. Ultimately, what we'll be looking at when the utilities come out a year from now with their proposals, we will look at I mentioned there was some wiggle room. There's a little bit of wiggle room in the sort of the prudence analysis of the thing. But if the if it's the wrong time, if it's the wrong technology, if it's extremely expensive, the commission has the opportunity to say this is not the right time, this is not the right technology. But if it's something that we think is worthwhile moving forward with, it helps the utility understand the value of storage better. They can move forward with it. So it's really the cost implications are at that stage.
Follow up. So to this point, this exercise has been free?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benson, it's as free as anything else that we do.
Follow up. Perhaps you can define what other things that you do cost, then we'll have a better measure of what this is costing.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benson, it is the law, and as such, we will implement it. And so we
follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
I need the answer. If you can, if you have to guess, tell me you're guessing. Is it $500,000? Is it $10,000? We need an answer, because the truth of it is, we've asked you to do something. We need to know what it's going to cost, because we can measure it against which we all think there's going to be a benefit. For goodness sakes, though, we need to know what the cost is. So please, if you need to get back to me, get back to
me. I can't. I will get back to you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. And you can stay there if you would like, because you're next up. The next discussion is going to be an update on the implementation of Senate Bill 1547. And Julie Peacock, welcome. And we're going to have three different panels come up for this one, so you guys are kicking us off here.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, I'm Julie Peacock. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor at the Public Utility Commission. I'm going to have to say next slide since Jason has the clicker. So on the slide, you can see the main activities the PUC has identified in order to implement SB 1547. Those dockets, those squares with numbers are open dockets currently at the commission. Those without numbers associated with them have not yet been opened at the commission. The ones that are open include a rulemaking on transportation electrification, an investigation into competitive bidding guidelines, and a rulemaking to develop a community solar program. This timeline also shows ongoing RPS responsibilities, such as the RPS compliance plans and the RPS implementation plans. Most of the activities highlighted here are projected times for the opening of dockets, but as you know, things can move around. They can be shorter or longer than what staff is projecting right now. And the commission has started with sections of the bill that have a statutory deadline for rule writing or having a program in place. So now I'll just briefly go over the sections of the bill that we've highlighted for PUC implementation, starting with the coal to clean section of the bill. It requires elimination of coal from Oregon's allocation of electricity. Staff identified that this would require an adjustment of the depreciation schedule associated with individual coal-fired power plants, which must occur prior to 2030. In October, Portland General Electric filed a request to adjust the depreciation schedules of Colstrip 3 and 4. The commission approved that adjustment schedule on December 6th, and the new schedule will go into effect on January 1st. Perhaps the largest section of the bill is the renewable portfolio standard adjustment portion of the bill. One thing to note here is that we do jointly administer the RPS with the Department of Energy. Things in the Department of Energy rule govern aspects of the RPS that relate to all utilities in the state. And the items that are in commission rule or order are only those items that relate to the utilities we regulate or the electricity service suppliers. The major change made by SB 1547 was to increase the compliance requirements for the state's large investor-owned utilities to 50% by 2040. Other items that may require commission process that are included within the RPS changes are renewable energy certificate banking rules that have changed for the large investor-owned utilities. These requirements do not impact the state's consumer-owned utilities. The commission also anticipates opening a process to review the current structure of our implementation and compliance plans. The implementation plans are filed on a biannual basis, and the compliance plans are filed every year. The third thing the commission anticipates is beginning in 2021, the state's electricity service suppliers will be required to comply with an 80% bundled requirement. Previously, they could comply with the RPS by using 100% unbundled RECs. And then the fourth thing that's probably most important to highlight is that during our most recent review process of our implementation plans, stakeholders requested that we revisit the incremental cost of compliance and how it's calculated. This review will happen next year in tandem with our overall RPS rulemaking. At the beginning of 2017, we also anticipate working to decide which elements of 1547 will fall into a general overall RPS rulemaking and which ones will require their own individual process. Okay, so transportation electrification. The commission completed a rulemaking in late November to establish the manner and form for the transportation electrification applications to be filed by the utilities by the end of the year. In its order finalizing the rules, the commission directed staff to open an additional process to develop guidelines for the content of transportation electrification plans. And those plans are long-term documents that will guide the future submittals to the commission. So as the utilities submit future programs, how those programs fit in with a long-term transportation electrification program. The commission anticipates a several months long process to review the transportation electrification applications that are to be filed by the December 31st at the end of this year. So those are two processes yet to come in transportation electrification. Perhaps the largest docket we have open right now is the community solar rulemaking. The commission opened a rulemaking earlier this summer to develop rules for the structure of community solar programs. Staff projects that initial draft rules will be completed in mid-April. We have a statutory deadline to have the rules finalized by July 1st. And after the rulemaking, we envision a time period in which we'll create the program, including developing a certification process, procedures for community solar projects, which the commission is required to certify community solar projects as part of the bill. And the process may take more or less time than what we have projected in the Gantt chart, which is 6 months. So small-scale, community-based renewables This section will require rulemaking on behalf of the commission. However, we understand that there's likely a legislative conversation about changes to this section of the bill in 2017. So anticipation of that conversation, we've put that rulemaking out beyond the 2017 legislative session. And as currently constructed, the requirement does not come into place until 2025. So there's additional time. The solar capacity standard, SB 1547, removed the requirement for the solar capacity standard. However, it retained the double credit. The solar capacity standard is currently in PUC rules, so we have to remove the requirement while retaining the credit that's associated with that program. And then finally, demand response. The bill indicated that, as directed by the commission, by rule or order, utilities should plan for and pursue the acquisition of cost-effective demand response resources. And we're unsure if integrating this into commission practice would require a rulemaking or informal investigation process or a contested case process, as the commission's policy of acquiring all cost-effective energy efficiency currently exists in commission order. We have given this an extended time frame due to the workload, a need for further scoping of how to integrate this into commission practice. And finally, reports to the legislature. So these reports are beyond the scope of our two-year timeline that we have provided to you, the first of which is a report on the community solar program, which is due by January 1st, 2019. And then the second is a report on SB 1547 and the rates, the impact on rates, the electric system reliability, greenhouse gas emissions, allocation of risk, the resource procurement process, and the eligibility and timing of cost recovery for RPS resources. I highlighted here because staff has definitely been thinking about this report specifically during its rulemaking and ensuring that we're getting the needed data in order to report back to the legislature on this item.
Chair Vega Peterson, I actually asked Julie to come up with this particular Gantt chart. So this shows the 1547 activity in the colored bars. But I also wanted to lay it on top of some of the other activities that the commission is undertaking anyway. And to a certain extent, this goes to Representative Bentz's question. While we don't look at the particular cost of any particular docket, I do think about the overall set of resources that we have at the commission and the kinds of activities that we're having to do. And so looking out at 2017 and 2018, there's a lot to do. So in the gray, what we call the current business activities includes our normal rate case activity if a utility comes forward with a rate case, and our normal integrated resource planning. But we also have additional dockets that are going on, some of which are very much related to the changing dynamics in the energy world. These are things that the commission has taken upon itself to begin exploring. So the resource value of solar, the Western independent system operator conversation is going on now, and it's requiring some of our time. We're looking forward potentially to working with the utilities and start thinking about what distribution system planning might look like. There is the storage docket that we were just talking about. So when you all add all those things up, it's going to be a remarkably busy year, not just for my staff, but for the utilities and the stakeholders as well. So just giving you the context of moving forward over the next year or two. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions for Jason or Julie? I had one question. So just based on a comment that you had, Julie, about the decisions that are going to be made, whether what is going to go into general rulemaking, what might be individual, is that going to have an impact on the timeline if you decide to break more out into the individual rulemaking?
It will. I mean, it depends on how many individual rulemakings for various aspects we decide to open. But at the same time, it might also speed things up if you do like a lot of scoping and you know that the scope of a particular rulemaking is fairly narrow. It's a little bit easier to move through that process versus having 20 issues as part of the rulemaking that you need to integrate.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank both of you for coming up. And the next two folks are going to have up, Scott Bolton and Ricky Seguin.
Good afternoon. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee.
Welcome.
Ricky Seguin, I work as the policy director with Renewable Northwest. On the agenda was Rachel Shimshak, who's our executive director, and Rachel has no voice right now, so I'm here delivering her comments in her place. She apologizes that she can't make it, but thank you for having me today. Renewable Northwest, we're a regional nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting environmentally responsible renewable resources across the region. So more wind and solar, and we're based here in Oregon, but we work across Oregon, Montana, Washington, and Idaho. And Renewable Northwest was a principal negotiator along with other advocates, as well as the utilities that you'll hear from today, in the First of the Nation Coal to Clean legislation. Thank you to the chair and vice chair for your support of the policy and hard work to get it over the finish line. Like any good piece of legislation, passing the bill is only the first step. The regulatory proceedings are really key in implementing the policy as it was intended, and we are engaged in nearly every one of the regulatory proceedings that Julie just mentioned. We want to commend the Public Utility Commission and ODO for their hard work in getting these processes set up quickly and all the work that they've put into a very massive amount of questions that need to be answered. And the work is very much underway. We have quite a bit to get figured out, quite a bit of work to do before the elements of the bill are fully fleshed out and there's regulatory clarity around different elements. In addition to all of the Senate Bill 1547 activity, PGE and PacifiCorp are both undertaking their integrated resource planning processes, which we'll hear about as well, to determine how to meet both customer needs and the requirements underneath the bill. Both utilities have done good analysis showing the value that renewable energy can provide to the system, and we're working with each of the companies through those processes to identify a future path that will ensure the continued reliable electricity services, as well as the generating need from renewables that ensure no new additional fossil fuel resources. And I'll also note that Senate Bill 1547 provides incentives for early action on renewable resources. We've learned a lot from the actions to date, which I know the companies will mention, and we're hopeful that both companies move forward with renewable energy acquisitions and make good use of the federal tax credits that are available for both wind and solar that'll provide benefit for the customers. So, in short, implementing the bill is a work in progress, but progress is being made, and we're happy to report that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Power. Pacific Power was first out of the gate, I guess you would say, in implementing Senate Bill 1547. The bill was signed into law by Governor Brown early in March, and on March 31st, we filed an updated integrated resource plan, which reflected the changes that we anticipated as a result of the new law. April 11th, we went out with a request for proposals for resources, for renewable resources to start testing the marketplace and looking at what will it cost to start meeting the new requirements. The RFP was pretty open-ended. There's a lot of different ways to acquire resources, everything from brand new projects to anybody out there that was looking to sell theirs, to different combinations of renewable energy credits or other mechanisms that are on the market. We went out pretty fast, but we felt compelled to do so because, as folks may recall, at the end of 2015, Congress extended the federal production tax credit for wind and the investment tax credit for solar power, and those credits ramped down over time. And so to be able to capture the full 100% value of the PTC, projects need to start in 2016 And so we wanted to make sure that we were well underway in assessing the market. The upshot is that we had hundreds of bids into that RFP, and then we evaluated really what is the lowest cost compliance strategy for our customers. And eventually what came out of it was seven projects that we procured the renewable rights or renewable energy certificates from. Of those seven, four are located here in Oregon. Six of them are solar power, and six of those feed directly into Pacific Corp's system. I think we handed out a map. We're doing it old school. I don't have a PowerPoint. But as you see on the map, the Oregon projects, three of which are located in Deschutes County, one in Klamath County, and all are community scale, small renewable scale projects of 10 megawatts or less. We have 20-year agreements for the RECs from those projects. And I think the best news of all of being able to go out and start making progress towards 1547's goals is that the entire cost of what effectively is an extra 3 years of really getting at the first stair step of increased renewable requirement under the legislation was under $10 million total. And what that means for our customers, for Oregon customers, that's about a one-time cost of a nickel on a $98 a month average residential retail bill. So that's a tremendous story. I think when we were here during February talking about this legislation and the craftsmanship of it, there was a lot of concern expressed around what's this going to cost, rightfully so. And at that point, we were being, I think, pretty optimistic that we think that we could meet the new standard for less than 1% rate impact per year, at least through the initial years. We think that this, at least the first 3 years of the new standard, will be at about one-tenth of even that assessment. So that's good news. It's a win for the small community scale renewable developers that we've worked with. It's a win for our customers, and we think that we're starting on the right path of faithfully executing this law. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? First, Scott Ricky. Oh, Representative Holby.
Thanks. I appreciate the presentation. I'm kind of curious, how do the ratepayers participate in these community solar projects? Are they do they subscribe to it? Do they own part of it? Do they get a credit on their bill for the participation, or do they pay extra in their bill per kilowatt hour?
Yep. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holby. It's kind of a nomenclature issue, so let me be even more clear. These are small community scale or small scale renewable projects. These are not part of the community solar program.
Okay.
So they participate simply by being a customer. There's no additional subscribership or additional action required by customers to participate in these projects. This is just the cost of bringing more electricity into our system.
Thank you. That clarifies it for me.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Scott, what's your relationship with Greg Walden?
We know each other.
I know him too.
Yeah.
Any follow up?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you both very much. Next, we're going to have some folks from PG come up, Varner Seaman and Franco Albi.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. First, I want to take a moment to recognize the work that the PUC is doing on the variety of dockets. Certainly, this has created the passage of Senate Bill 1547 has created some work for the PUC. We very much appreciate the work that the staff and the commission is doing to implement the law. We feel very good about the process that's going on, and we appreciate the process that they're running. So thanks to the PUC for that. As we discussed when we were working on Senate Bill 1547, and as we talked talk, I think, a lot in this committee. We have a what we believe is a pretty robust integrated resource planning process. And as we implement Senate Bill 1547, the way that we're going to be planning to do that and then eventually procuring resources is going to be based on the integrated resource process. So this is a process at the Public Commission that is overseen by the Commission and Commission staff with very robust opportunity for stakeholder input. To that end, I brought with me today Franco Albi, who is the head of our resource planning within PGE. He's been at the company for over 10 years. He has a master's degree in engineering, as well as an MBA, and is a licensed engineer. What we submitted the integrated resource plan as a filing recently to the PUC. It's a short document, about 803 pages. I sent to this committee the executive summary, which is maybe the longest executive summary in existence, about 40 pages. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Franco to talk about some details in terms of the resource planning process. Thank you.
Thank you, Varner. Good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Franco Albi. I work for Portland General Electric as the manager of integrated resource planning. I've just got a few slides. I'm not going to read the entire integrated resource plan for you today, although that would
appreciate
be
that.
Entertaining for all. So thank you for hearing my testimony. For the next few minutes, I am going to talk about the 2016 Integrated Resource Plan, or IRP, briefly share what it is, highlighting some of the key components of the plan, and describe how it supports implementation of provisions within Senate Bill 1547, which, as you all know, is the Oregon Clean Electricity and Coal Transition Plan, which was enacted into law in March of 2016. I'll also show a slide on how PGE's IRP keeps us on the path to reach Oregon's long-term carbon reduction goals. All right, so let's start with what is the Integrated Resource Plan? The IRP is an assessment of the long-term needs of PGE's customers and evaluation of the company's options to provide customers the safe, sustainable, affordable, and reliable power they desire. It's also the strategic roadmap demonstrating how PGE will deliver on our carbon reduction goals. So as you can imagine, and as Varner mentioned, this is an extremely detailed and complex analysis. It's over 800 pages, but we can really look at it through the lens of these three integrated components that deliver that long-term sustainability. So we all need energy to power our lives, and smart use or energy management, that first piece, is our lowest cost resource. The 2016 IRP recommends acquiring all cost-effective energy efficiency and over 300% more demand response than was identified in our 2013 IRP. When it comes to the renewable expansion, PGE has been integrating wind and solar resources for over a decade, and we're carrying that experience and expertise forward to implement Oregon's expanded renewable portfolio standard to 50% by 2040. So in the 2016 IRP, we determined that early year acquisition of renewables higher than even the Senate Bill 1547 milestones is supported. And these resources can be any RPS qualified renewables, including wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, or incremental hydro. The third component of the IRP, that technology integration piece, optimizes the use of energy management and renewable expansion components. So because customers use energy differently every day and renewable resources rely on nature for their fuel, their profiles can be quite variable, but we can manage that variability. We can make sure that we have the right resources to respond as needed when they're needed. Some of those tools briefly include diversity, both in resource technology and geography, flexibility, such as fast-acting efficient resources like hydro, natural gas, and energy storage, and optimization through deployment of smart grid technologies. And the overarching goal of the technology integration piece is to use the right resources at the right time and the right quantities. So as we look at meeting the needs of our customers, PGE is proud to have served in Oregon for over 125 years, and we look forward to providing energy for the next 125 years and beyond, not personally, but the company as a whole. We take seriously our duty to deliver that safe, reliable, and affordable power by using increasingly sustainable energy solutions. So Oregon's economy is a key driver of PGE's customer energy usage projection, which is shown on the chart by the black line. So our short-term forecast, which is 2017 to 2021, reflects the continued improvement of the state's economy as we recover from the impacts of the Great Recession. And the long-term outlook, which goes out through 2040 to the right side of the chart, is also positive for future economic and population growth, both in Oregon and in PGE's service territory specifically. So a key objective of the IRP process is to identify the gap between our customers' needs and the capabilities of our existing resources to meet those needs. So PGE's existing resources, both ones that we own and that we contract for, are represented by the stacked colors in the charts. The resource needs of the future are represented by the gap between the color stack and the black line. And that's mainly driven by the transition away from coal and the need to maintain our reliability requirements. So we're committed to making the right decisions for our customers and for our region, and we recognize that it's a complex environment with evolving policy, technology, reliability, and price factors that all need to be balanced. And on this last slide, PG&E and our customers are also committed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to climate change. By implementing the 2016 IRP Action Plan, it keeps us on the right trajectory to reach Oregon's long-term carbon reduction goals and continue towards a sustainable future. So our plan forecasts CO2 emissions consistent with, and actually even better than, our initial Senate Bill 1547 estimates, which we can explore in this chart. So the way to interpret this chart is from the top down, and each color represents the amount of carbon dioxide emissions avoided. So for example, if we did nothing and CO2 emissions would follow the trajectory at the top of the blue wedge, they'd increase over time. But we are taking actions, and by implementing energy efficiency, expanding renewables, and removing coal from Oregon's generation mix, we avoid the CO2 emissions of the blue, teal, and dark gray wedges. So a key point that's also illustrated here is that the emission reductions don't happen overnight. We're taking continuous incremental actions to get to where we want to go, which is to be a company that our customers and our communities can depend on to provide electric service in a safe, sustainable, and reliable manner with excellent service at a reasonable price. So that concludes my prepared remarks, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard from CityCorps that the cost of compliance was modest. Is that the same for your company? I note that the coal dependence looks to be considerable on the PG&E side. Are the ratepayers there going to be facing a different future than those for PacifiCorp?
Madam Chair, Representative Vance, thank you for that question. Our cost estimates that we prepared for Senate Bill 1547 back in the spring showed that we had modest cost increases as well, up to 1.5% annualized over the course of the implementation of the bill through 2040. We haven't procured resources as PacifiCorp did in the first initial year, so we don't have hard numbers to go by, but our forecasts remain the same, that those price increases would be modest.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Franco, you used the word procurement, and I know that plays a huge role in these projections going out. We're going to have a presentation on a cap and trade program later on in this hearing. I just wonder, how might that factor into your long range procurement strategies, and have, in fact, you modeled what that might do or the impact that it might have on that long range line that you're referring to there?
Yeah. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, we have modeled CO2 prices in our integrated resource plan, everything from zero CO2 price up to $500 per short ton, and that trajectory remains the same. What changes is the cost of compliance with that trajectory.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Hello, Madam Chair.
Yes, let me get Rep. Pulvan, then you can do follow-up.
I was just curious if, you know, a lot of the information I've seen goes to 2040. Are there projections beyond that?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Hobley, while the implementation graphs go out to 2040, we do have information out to 2050. We expect that there will be additional actions that are required to maintain the lower emission rates at that time, but haven't presented those in these charts.
No follow-up.
Yeah. What kind of actions are you perceiving after 2040?
I think it's undetermined as far as what those would be. The policy may change between now and then as well. So that's one of the benefits of the long-term resource plan is we look out to the extent that we can, and as changes are made, we adjust our forecast accordingly to that. I guess by way of example, if you went to an 80% renewable portfolio standard by 2050 or 100% by 2060 or whatever the numbers in the years were, there would have to be a revisiting of the assumptions that were made and creation of different portfolios to meet those requirements.
Thanks. Okay. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we go back to your other slide?
Sure.
And the space between the space that's blank, on your model that you mentioned, what do you anticipate that space will be filled with? Is that natural gas generation? Are those the foundation for the numbers of 1.5%?
Chair Vigor Peterson, Representative Benz, the mix of resources that will fill that gap is the world of available resources. So natural gas is one. It also includes existing resources, hydro, solar, wind, geothermal, biomass. And what would determine what would actually fill those gaps would be through a competitive bidding request for proposal process.
Follow up. Right, so the reading I've done suggests it's going to be mostly natural gas, although you can throw the rest of the stuff in there. Is that reading correct or incorrect when it comes to a percentage of what's going to fill that space? What's going to be most of it is my question.
We're talking about capacity.
Yeah, sure. So Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz. The chart that's shown here is the capacity need versus, say, the energy need. So the amount that a resource can contribute to the peak or the instantaneous need for power is what's shown here. Natural gas is a resource that can meet that need. As I said, so is hydro, so is geothermal. The contributions from renewables, such as wind and solar, also can fill a portion of that. So it's speculative to say, you know, which one resource would be filling most of it. I think there's also additional technologies, which we heard from Mr. Eisdorfer, related to energy storage, that could become available and at a cost-effective rate and fill some of that gap as well.
Final follow-up.
Okay,
so we know you're going to do the best for your ratepayers. You're going to get the lowest cost consistent with whatever the requirements of clean air are. That would be natural gas. Thanks to some of you guys' contribution, sending me back to the Lehigh Conference, which I deeply appreciate. I learned all of this. And I'm just asking you a question I think we all know the answer to. I don't blame you for not answering it as directly as I would like. But I appreciate it. How about this? Will some of it be natural gas?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz. We are, again, open to all the options. I respect the direct question. And when we look at our resource portfolio, gas is definitely in the mix of options. That said, it's impossible to determine for sure which resource will be in there. And when we look at the resource mix, we're looking at the balance of cost and risk. So that's one of the reasons we look at that long term. You know, what are some of the variables out there? CO2 pricing is one. Natural gas pricing is another. There are many, many factors beyond that.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz, and I think one of the reasons why Franco isn't giving a simple yes-no is after we go through, just to remind folks of the process, the integrated resource plan needs to be acknowledged by the Public Utility Commission. Once acknowledged, we anticipate doing a request for proposals. Where we would like to see that go is that we would be bidding for attributes, for renewable attributes to meet the 1547 requirement, and then also bidding for opening a competitive process for capacity resources. I think it's reasonable to expect that natural gas will bid into that request for proposals, and that natural gas with the prices would likely be competitive. We don't know what other resources would bid in. If there were hydro resources that could meet that capacity and were cheaper, potentially those resources would outcompete. And if that was judged by the PUC to be the least cost, least risk, we'd procure a different resource other than that. Although, I mean, to your question, you know, is natural gas likely to be competitive? Yes, it's likely to be competitive, but we can't prefigure that process without knowing, one, what the final determination is on the IRP, and then second, what direction we have from the commission.
Follow up. Is this the final follow-up?
It is. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's actually just a remark. Mm-hmm. And it goes like this. This is why we probably needed an energy department, because at the end of the day, this particular legislator simply doesn't enjoy the understanding you do, and we need someone to interpret for us. So, yes. Energy department might help us do that. So this is a well-timed hearing since we just went through that a few minutes ago. So I'm complex. Appreciate you guys' care and how you answer my questions.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both very much. We are going to move away from the implementation of Senate Bill 1547 and talk about wood smoke in Oregon from House Bill 3068 in 2015. So I'd invite Palmer Mason and Rachel Cicada to come up. It's good to see both of you. And as soon as you're settled, feel free to get started.
Good morning, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative advisor for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. You've asked us here today to talk about wood smoke. And specifically, we are here to talk about a report that's a follow-up to House Bill 3068, which I think is a bill this committee is very well familiar with. I want
to. And Palmer, I'm sorry, I meant to say something, so I apologize for interrupting. But this is something that actually came out in September, and unfortunately, we didn't have time during the September legislative days. But I do know that this is interest of all of us, including me personally, to hear that. So I'm just so glad that you guys were able to come to the December legislative days.
And we're very grateful for the opportunity to talk about this bill, especially since it was a bill that Vice Chair Johnson sponsored. And Rachel will go into the details about what the report recommends for additional action on reducing wood smoke. So I'll let her talk about that in the process, about how we came up with assembling a work group and putting together a set of recommendations. I did want to just say one additional thing. And that is, at DEQ, we spend a lot of time these days talking about air quality. In fact, some days it feels like that's all we ever talk about. And there's a lot of conversations around diesel, reducing diesel emissions, and there's a great deal of conversation around how to address emissions from industrial facilities. But the one thing that doesn't get maybe as much time is the wood smoke issue. So I think this report is a great reminder of the fact that wood smoke is one of the larger sources of air toxics in Oregon. So it's not only a health risk, though, but it's also can be an economic barrier for all of our communities, but particularly for our rural communities. And so I think it's timely that we are talking about it. And to echo what I said a moment ago, we are very grateful that you scheduled this. So thanks.
Great. Good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Cicada, and I'm an air quality planner with the DEQ, and I'm the key staff person who led the DEQ wood smoke work group. So you've seen parts of this before, but just to reiterate it again, wood stove smoke is a problem in many communities across Oregon as they struggle to meet the federal air quality standards for particulate matter, or PM2.5. And particulate matter in wood stove smoke is easily inhaled. It can reach the deepest part of their lungs. It can cause or contribute to respiratory disease, asthma, cardiac problems, and even premature death. Wood smoke also contains air toxics, as Palmer mentioned, and so they are known to cause cancer. And overall, wintertime residential wood burning is the most significant source of particulate matter in most communities in or on the verge of non-attainment. So what does non-attainment mean? So it basically means that the area is violating the federal health standard for air pollutants. Now, Oregon has had a long history of addressing non-attainment in communities. And back in the 1980s, we had a number of areas violating the standards for particulate matter, and they've all been brought back into compliance. And we're still challenged because over the years, EPA has made the particulate health matter standard progressively more protective for public health. And as you can see by the graph on the right, in 2006, the last time they revised the standard, it was lowered by almost half, down to 35 micrograms per meters cubed. And so as the standard gets lower and lower, that has made it difficult for past non-attainment communities to stay in compliance, and it has put new areas at risk of non-attainment. And so you can see from the map there, those are areas that were formerly non-attainment areas. The big red ones are those areas that are currently non-attainment, so they're currently violating the federal health standard, and some other areas of concern. So across Oregon, the high PM2.5 levels driving the non-attainment risk are universally caused by excessive wood stove smoke. So because of the growing concern about the health and economic effects of wood smoke in communities across Oregon, Representative Johnson here sponsored House Bill 3068 during the 2015 legislative session. And the bill directed DEQ to conduct a study and develop recommendations for legislation to reduce wood stove smoke in Oregon, and in particular in communities where attainment of the national air quality standard is a concern. And so the bill also directed DEQ to explore options to switch out old wood stoves for cleaner burning devices, to look into the use and production of biomass fuel, and explore options for reducing the cost of wood stove alternatives during poor air quality days. So DEQ formed a work group to help conduct the study and develop recommendations. And the work group members reflected a range of stakeholders affected by wood stove smoke and biomass, including those from rural and urban communities. And so up there on the map sort of gives a representation of who was there. And we had a number of city and local officials. The mayor of Oak Ridge was there. I believe there's a few members in the audience here on the work group who are in attendance. And so the work group held five meetings, and in the middle of the process, we also conducted a road show around the state. And so this shows you where we went. So we went to seven communities across the state, basically to solicit feedback and hear additional suggestions for work group consideration. And the work group took these thoughts and considered them in their final recommendations. And overall, the work group had really good discussions about regarding the realities of how communities are trying to tackle the problem and what will and will not work. And that includes an acknowledgement of a strong culture of wood stove use, a lack of staffing to implement programs, an easily accessible wood supply, and economic barriers to struggling communities. And so the recommendations provided to the legislature focus on what is needed to be successful in tackling the wood smoke issue and helping these communities. Overall, these recommendations enhance state and local partnerships focused on reducing the health effects of wood smoke and to remove potential regulatory barriers to economic development that could be caused by a federal non-attainment designation in local communities. And so to achieve the goal of helping Oregon communities reduce wood smoke, the report highlights three priority recommendations for legislative consideration. So the first key recommendation the DEQ and the work group identified to reduce wood smoke must involve increased community funding. So locally run wood smoke reduction programs are critical to maintaining or achieving clean air, and at least part-time programs are required for some of the former non-attainment communities under their federally approved clean air plans. And so local communities understand the challenges of their area and can craft effective wood smoke reduction programs that include wood stove curtailment and education and outreach messages that are specifically tailored for their residents. So, for example, a curtailment program asks or requires residents to curtail the use of their wood burning appliance during poor air quality days, and they can be either voluntary or mandatory depending on the severity of the air quality program and based on the available resources. So this measure can be highly effective at reducing wood smoke and has been successfully implemented in a number of communities such as Klamath Falls, Oak Ridge, Hillsborough, and Washington County, just to name a few. The other locally implemented wood smoke reduction programs include the ability to expand education and outreach for communities and also for communities to solicit grants and matching funds to conduct their work. And so right now, current state funding of approximately $170,000 per biennium only covers part of the cost to implement minimal wood smoke reduction programs in about seven communities. And so by increasing the funding for local wood smoke reduction by a range of about $550,000 to $700,000 per biennium, each community could employ a full or part-time dedicated staff to help implement various programs mentioned above, such as the curtailment program, expanding education and outreach efforts, even helping to administer a wood stove changeout program, and also could potentially expand the number of communities that could receive funding to conduct the wood smoke reduction programs. And so locally implemented community programs are one of the most effective ways to reduce wood smoke in an area. And without their partnership and involvement, many communities will be at continued risk or potentially in danger of violating the federal air quality standard. Increased funding will allow these areas to fully address or enhance their ability to address wood smoke. So another recommendation included sustained funding for wood stove changeouts. And so there are approximately 150,000 uncertified wood stoves in the state, and these old stoves are a reason for why areas are at risk of violating the health standards. And just to give you an idea, old stoves are about 3 to 10 times more polluting than just a certified stove. And Oregon has had a long and successful history of replacing wood stove in certain communities, but money is sporadic and limited to just one-time-only grants. And so, for example, in 2009, we had $2 million, which we were able to disperse to about five or six communities there. And then most recently, in 2015, we had $1.5 million from the Regional Solutions to give to Klamath Falls and Lakeview to do changeouts. So essentially, sustained funding is the only way to ensure communities have a consistent, reliable source of funding to do changeouts. And the recommendations focus on these replacements to be able to lower PM levels within the next 5 to 10 years, particularly in the critical airsheds where air quality is a concern. And we can't afford to wait and hope that a grant will come along, and we need to put a funding source in place now that communities can rely on. And so the recommendations include an allocation in the range of $3 to $5 million per biennium that could target high-risk communities and support a meaningful level of effort to replace old, dirty wood stoves. So this chart here just kind of gives a rough estimate of the number of stoves that can be replaced by the funding amount and the estimated reduction in air pollutants. And I'll just note, there are a lot of variables involved with this that can affect these numbers. For example, it depends on whether the change-out program covers a full replacement cost of the device, which is, you know, the purchase and installation of a wood stove, or if it provides only for a partial rebate. So the top number, if you look, say, for example, the $1 million, the $290 would be if you're doing all full rebates, and then the bottom number would be if you're doing all partial, so you're kind of looking at anything in between the range. The reason why I say that is that from past change-out programs, many communities often offer a combination of the two, but the allocation of the full replacement rebates and the versus the partial rebates really depends on the makeup of the community. So, for example, in a community like Oak Ridge or Lakeview, you may have a higher percentage of full rebates as opposed to other areas of the state where you may have more of a mix of the two. And also the type of device being replaced has an effect on the emission reduction and the overall cost of how many devices can be replaced. So, for example, a pellet stove can offer a greater emissions reduction than a certified wood stove, and a gas or electric device can offer even more reduction, but the cost of replacing these devices is more than just a certified wood stove. So basically, DEQ's experience to date with wood stove changeouts shows that this is a multi-year effort requiring sustained funding. The ongoing funding provides a level of continuity for communities to know that there will be a multi-year funding source that, to do changeouts and be part of the larger effort within the communities to address wood smoke. So the last key recommendation is to increase education and outreach across the state on the health effects of excessive wood smoke. Increasing awareness of the wood smoke problem is an essential component to implementing effective reduction programs, because basically, if residents don't understand why reducing wood smoke is important, then needed or existing locally based reduction programs could fail or be severely hindered. So to date, limited state and local resources have resulted in limited outreach, and so with an additional staff person and technology support, the state could develop a suite of tools and programs that local communities and residents could use to address their individual outreach and education needs. And this could include things like creating educational videos in multiple languages to reach potentially underserved communities, expanding the community's social media presence through Facebook and Twitter, and providing year-round education through informational billboards, radio spots, newspapers, and television ads. So here is a link to the final report in case you want to do any nighttime, bedtime reading. And essentially, in conclusion, Oregon has had a long history of addressing wood smoke in the state, and attaining federal air quality standards would not have been possible without the state and local partnerships to tackle the wood smoke problem. DEQ and local communities continue to work together to develop community plans and strategies to reduce wood smoke levels, and these recommendations build upon the past successes of the state and local efforts and provide a targeted, coordinated approach to ramp up state-local effort to reduce wood stove smoke. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Questions for Palmer or Rachel? Representative Palm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rachel, can you explain to me if there is an intersection between the residential energy tax credits and how we treat wood stoves, and if there is, how if you could estimate the impact there?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Helm, there is an intersection. Currently, there is a tax credit available for the purchase of a premium efficiency wood-burning device. So that can apply to a certified wood stove or a pellet stove. And so there are a number of residents who have taken advantage of that. I don't have the exact numbers on me right now, but I can certainly get that for you.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Could you pull up that slide which showed the state and the non-attainment areas and former non-attainment areas?
Let's see if I can get back to it.
It's three.
That's back at the beginning.
There we go.
There you go. Perfect. So we have on here some locations, LeGrand, Lakeview, Medford, Grants Pass, that are former non-attainment areas. What was the source of bringing them from non-attainment to former non-attainment? What was the actions contributed to that?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, a lot of the strategies that are currently in place now, so, for example, they did wood stove curtailment programs back then. They also did wood stove changeouts, just education outreach. Because back then, people didn't really know about the wood smoke problem, and so it was just sort of the awareness there. And so they were able to bring the levels down quickly, and the levels have continued to stay down, at least within LeGrand and Grants Pass and Eugene Springfield area. So that's been the great news. But, you know, communities are still challenged. You know, when you get cold weather inversions, that really makes it difficult for a lot of areas and, you know, with a lot of wood smoke use. And so it just requires a lot of continued education and outreach and just more and more changeouts.
So these efforts are mainly kind of community-based efforts at this, apart from a concerted state effort.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, yes. It's a lot of it, we developed state plans with the locals, but a lot of it has been just the local involvement because they know what works in their community.
So we do have two non-attainment areas, though, correct? I bring that up partially because, as Palmer well knows, we're dealing with another issue with particulate matter and diesel, where Oregon doesn't actually have any non-attainment areas for diesel particulate matter, but we do on wood stove particulate matter. But this issue gets so little or less attention, if I might add. And if we want to talk about public health concerns, we really might have some here. So that's just a comment. But my question would be, in the work group and so forth, was there interest expressed, or did the topic come up about how there may be an opportunity for, let's just say, private sector public-private partnerships on providing some of that revenue that you're talking about, or the financial resources, especially if some of these communities that are non-attainment may be then having problems in terms of furthering industrial development or other sort of economic development? Did that topic come up at all, and was there any interest expressed on the part of the private sector for helping in the short term so that it could open up development opportunities long term?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, that certainly came up during the committee discussions, just in terms of, you know, what other avenues are there to get sources of funding. One of the things was, you know, as I mentioned earlier, just being able to solicit grants, and they're saying that knowing if they have a pot of money that they can provide in kind, and as they go out to solicit these grants, that will help them considerably. There has been some participation from some private sources in some communities, and it just sort of depends on the level of involvement. But communities are getting more resourceful in terms of how to find funding, because, as you know, funding is always hard to find. And so they're certainly looking at different avenues. But I think for many communities, what we heard is having a consistent source, even if they know that they're going to get, say, $40,000 a year, really helps them plan. So then they can say, okay, we need to go out to these other sources to say, we need this extra money to help us run our program, just to do the education outreach or do wood stove changeouts, things like that, because I know they've been able to do that successfully in some areas like Washington County and so on and so forth. So that's been great.
Yeah, I'd like to add, too. I think we see this a lot, and it's probably typical in other areas. If the state is able to put some money towards this problem, then I think that money begets money. By putting some seed money out there, we can attract from community foundations, from nonprofits, federal dollars potentially, and private dollars. And it sort of, you know, it builds upon it, becomes a catalyst for attracting more. I also heard, Representative Johnson, it sounded like your question was about the economic issues, the potential economic issues. I wasn't, unfortunately, able to attend very many of the work group meetings myself, but I did attend the first one or two, and I do remember something that it was either the gentleman who was on the work group from either Hillsborough or the city of Washington, or county of Washington County, And they were at risk here recently of potentially being considered non-attainment. And they passed along what their economic development director from the county said. He said the economic development environment for local governments around the country is so competitive that if we got non-attainment status, he said, quite frankly, you could kiss my job goodbye. You know, it would just be too hard to do. So I think that sort of stuck with me, that there is certainly a public health component to this, but there's very much an economic component to this particular issue.
Good. Thank you.
Representative Polvey.
Oh, thanks. I'm not sure if I heard you correctly. Could you clarify something for me? You were talking about the cleanliness of wood stoves versus pellet stoves, and then you mentioned also natural gas as being cleaner than the wood burning, even the certified wood stoves and the pellet stoves. So back to Representative Helms' question, is that RETSI also applied to changing out wood stoves to natural gas stoves?
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, I'd have to double check about the RETSI tax credit for natural gas appliances. And this tax credit only applies towards the purchase, so it does not apply towards any change outs per se. So you don't get a tax credit if you're changing out a stove. It's just if anyone's looking to purchase a stove. So whether they are planning to change out, they'll get the tax credit, or say they want a secondary source of heat, they'll get the tax credit. So there's nothing, you don't have an additional tax or a separate tax rate just for change outs alone.
And I know in conversations that I've had on about this topic is that sometimes the issue is getting the natural gas to the people who are using the wood stoves currently. They don't have the pipelines or the facilities to have the natural gas switch out done. Yeah, follow up?
A different question.
Okay, go for it.
Thanks. And so I was also following this issue of non-attainment in areas, and I know I'm from the Eugene Springfield area where LRAPA has programs for alerts when we start approaching non-attainment, and they have ordinances against using fireplaces, wood stoves, and you know, actually have enforcement actions subsequent to that if anybody's breaking the rules, and you know, they, unless they have, you know, it's their only source of heat, for example. But when those events happen, I've always been curious how do you, I mean, you must delineate what's coming from wood stoves versus industry. For example, we have biomass generation, you know, plants in certain areas, like in my community. And it always kind of made me quizzical when I see that wood stoves are, you know, the alert goes out, you can't burn wood stoves, but the biomass facilities continue to operate, you know, for, you know, probably many good reasons. But, you know, is there a quantification of how much of the wood smoke's coming from those biomass facilities, generation facilities, as opposed to the wood smokes in particular communities?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Holby, probably the best way to answer your question is when we look at the PM levels in a community, what we'll find is the highest levels are typically in the wintertime when we see a lot of wood stove use. So, for example, like a biomass facility is going to operate year-round. And so we see huge spikes in the winter when it's mostly the wood stove burning. Also, we see that there are diurnal effects. So, for example, you'll see the levels start to rise at around 6 p.m. at night when everyone comes home and starts firing up their wood stoves, and then it starts to get even higher and higher until about midnight, and then everyone goes to sleep. And you see the levels drop again, and then you see another little peak in the morning, and then by the daytime, the levels get back low again because everyone's at work and no one's firing up their wood stoves. So we really see that it attributed to wood stoves because of the markers of, like I said, the diurnal effects as well as the wintertime peaks.
I won't do a follow-up. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to, but
go ahead.
Well, I guess, you know, so when we cite biomass plants, and they're sort of become the baseline, and so you recognize the up and down of the wood stoves. And so we cite another biomass plant, and all of a sudden our base level is a lot higher, so it's much easier to impact that non-attainment area with wood stoves. And the pressure then is usually you know, plays out on the wood stove operators that or you know, consumers that need to shut down their operations while we continue to build the airshed with other, you know, pollutants, I guess. And so it just doesn't seem like there's a, you know, you get to a point where, you know, you're not going to be able to have wood stoves at all if you keep increasing your airshed or filling your airshed capacity with other sources. I'm just trying to figure out how to balance that, and how does DEQ and you know balance that? I suppose when we're looking at you know increasing our industrial sources.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm Representative Holvey. Representative Holvey, you and I have had this discussion a couple different times. I mean, I think one solution is not to decrease the use of wood stoves or sort of ban wood stoves or limit their usage. I think ideally here we would give people better options for home heating, whether it's a certified stove or natural gas or a better pellet stove or something like that. The federal standard, the particulate standard here, the daily standard, requires a facility, an industrial facility, whether they're relocating to an area or expanding, to take into account the other sources in order to get their permit. And so I hear what you're saying. With every additional industrial facility we add, it adds another increment of particulate to the air. It gets a little more difficult. But back to the point that Rachel made, and I think there's other studies and monitoring data that we have this, in most of the communities where we are constrained around particulate matter, and I'm not just talking the non-attainment areas. We have places that are kind of on the bubble and potentially can fall into non-attainment, which we don't want to have happen. It is largely the wood smoke issue. They are the largest contributor of that particulate matter. So if we can get people better home heating options, then we take away most of the problem. And this, so it's not an impediment now to industry whether they're going to relocate or expand. It gives people a better option, so and they actually probably can burn their wood and their heating sources more efficiently. So there's a gain for them, as well as we get healthy air. I mean, those are some of the underlying reasons that led us to make the recommendations we did in the report. I agree with you. There's a finite capacity to meeting that federal standard, but I think that really the solution is in giving people better home heating options.
Anyone else? Okay. Thank you both for giving such a great detailed report, and thank you for all the work and going around the state to talk to people about this issue. This is actually something that I see carrying over into my next job, because I know that Jay Douglas and folks at Multnomah County are working on this, so I'm going to continue to stay involved in this issue and looking at how Multnomah County can work with Washington and Clackamas counties to take this on. So thank you guys very much for that.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, and Palmer, you stay put,
yep.
And we're going to have Colin McConaughey come up, and we're going to talk about the draft report for the considerations for designing a cap-and-trade program in Oregon. This was something that came out of a Senate bill from last session. The final report isn't due until, I think, next month or February, but I appreciate you taking the time to come to talk about the draft report. This is one of those things that I see as being a possible topic of consideration in the 17th session, so I wanted to start the discussion with taking a look at this report. So. It's a budget.
It was a budget.
She's on it. Well, I'll go ahead and start. So for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative advisor for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Thanks for having us here today to talk about a draft study that DEQ was directed to provide to the legislature. I'm going to talk really about background in terms of how we got to the study and what we were directed to do around the study. And then Colin's going to take you actually through the findings and the background and really the study itself. As the chair alluded to, this study was a part of legislative action in the short session in 2016. It was a budget note that as a part of the budget bill directed DEQ to look at several questions around the pricing of carbon and greenhouse gases. And the reason for the budget note was, and I don't really probably need to belabor this with the committee, climate change legislation has been a conversation in this legislature over the last several sessions. And there was, of course, a bill in the short session in 2016, Senate Bill 1574, the Healthy Climate Act legislation. That bill didn't pass, but what came out of it was this budget note directing DEQ to look at the issue of market mechanisms to price carbon. And we were specifically looking at several key questions around that issue. And Colin will kind of talk through those more in more detail as he goes through the study. But that's the context for this particular study, and I'll let Colin shift into the actual study.
Great. Thanks, Palmer. For the record, my name is Colin McConaughey. I am the climate policy advisor at the Department of Environmental Quality. And I'll just note that the quotation up there on the screen is the actual language in Senate Bill 5701 directing DEQ to provide information for the 2017 legislative session on how a market-based carbon reduction system would work in Oregon. Fortunately, I think legislature also provided a further direction to DEQ to focus that study on four key considerations for how Oregon might design and implement a market mechanism for reducing greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon. The first consideration was probably the most important as far as defining the contours of this study, what we looked at and what we didn't. And this first direction from legislature was for us to assess the scope and stringency of a market mechanism necessary to do two things. First, to achieve Oregon's greenhouse gas reduction goals. And secondly, the scope and the stringency of a program necessary to link the program with other jurisdictions. And that really defined, that the language there really defined what we looked at. And what we looked at was one particular market mechanism that I suspect many members of this committee have heard of. It's a cap and trade program, and specifically a cap and trade program that would be compatible to link with the existing cap and trade programs that are currently linked between California and Quebec. The scope of the program refers to the breadth of emission sources that would be covered under that cap, and then the stringency of the program is the relationship of where that cap or emission limit is set relative to those collective sources of emissions. So just real briefly, how a cap-and-trade program works is that the state determines what sources of emissions are covered by the cap, where to set that cap or that overall limit on emissions from those sources of emissions. And then the state issues permits to emit greenhouse gases. These permits are often referred to as allowances and typically take the form of 1 ton of carbon dioxide equivalent. The state issues allowances up to that limit or that cap. There's a number of ways, and I'll mention a few of these, the state can issue these allowances. Once they are issued, there is subsequently a market for trading or buying and selling these allowances, hence the market function of this of a program like this. The second area of consideration that legislature asked us to look into was how a program like this would interact with existing state climate policies, and called out specifically, in particular, the Renewable Portfolio Standard and the Clean Fuels Program. The third area for consideration in this study was how a program like this could mitigate some obvious impacts that would otherwise be incurred on businesses by establishing this emissions or pollution limit. One of the key areas in this regard for us to look into was something called leakage, and that's a term that's used to describe the potential for a program like this to push businesses or their output and the jobs associated with that business output, push that outside the state as a way for the business to avoid paying the price to pollute here in Oregon. And that's a really serious consequence potentially of a program like this because it neither reduces pollution overall, it just shifts it outside the state, and incurs obvious economic consequences here in Oregon. So looking at what the literature has to say about ways to avoid or minimize that effect, that leakage effect, and how existing cap and trade programs that are in place today have minimized that effect.
Another area in this consideration that we looked into was how revenue that could be generated by this program through the sale of those allowances or permits to emit greenhouse gases, how that revenue could be used to mitigate effects on specific businesses that are high energy users or reliant on products that are energy intensive. And then finally, assessing how that linkage that was in the request from legislature, how linking our program to other jurisdictions might affect Oregon businesses. The fourth and final area for consideration that legislature directed us to look into is how a program like this could both positively and negatively affect disadvantaged populations and rural communities across the state. And one of the clear, obvious areas in this regard for us to look into was how, again, that revenue that could be generated by a program like this, how that could be used to offset the potentially disproportionate effect of energy, of the carbon cost on these communities and those households. Before I get into some of the preliminary findings that we have included, I should just run through the process that we have taken to conduct this study. We got the request from legislature in March, and by June we had issued the request for proposal for a consultant to provide some macroeconomic modeling of how a program like this would affect Oregon's economy. And we also kicked off the project at a public stakeholder meeting in June. And then throughout the summer and the fall, we conducted considerable amount of research and interviews with other jurisdictions that have programs like this, continued to meet with stakeholders and interested parties about this policy or program type. And then just last month, we released a public draft for comment, and that comment period will close on December 22nd. And then next Monday, December 19th, DEQ is hosting a public meeting to receive comments on that draft as well. And then finally, we expect to publish a final draft in February in time for the next legislative session. Okay, so getting into the some of the preliminary findings that we highlight in this draft study, one of the first things we ran across when looking at a market program like this is the importance or value of linking markets, linking a program like this between jurisdictions by establishing a marketplace that provides a mechanism for linking a program, somewhat unlike many other types of policies, and that there are real benefits to that linkage and joining a larger and more economically diverse marketplace, particularly to a smaller jurisdiction like Oregon's. Those benefits come in the form of simply covering a far greater number and types of emission sources that can potentially offer greater number of more cost-effective emission reductions, emission reductions, as well as just more practical considerations about joining a marketplace that has established administrative functions for administering a program like this. Oregon would not have to create from whole cloth the entire administrative apparatus to implement a program like this. There's also, we did early on encounter a lot of debate or comparison between a market program like this and other carbon pricing mechanisms, chiefly a carbon tax, and frankly discovered, I think, more benefits to a market program like this than there are to a carbon tax. The ability to trade these allowances, as I already described, should in theory allow for lower cost emission reductions, holding everything else constant between a program like this and a carbon tax that just sets a flat fee on emissions. And another thing we found, again, pretty early on in the literature and in talking with jurisdictions that have designed programs like this, is that there's real value to designing the program as broadly as possible. I mentioned the scope earlier and the direction from legislature to look at the scope necessary to achieve Oregon's goals and to link with other programs. And covering as many sources of emissions as is feasible for a program like this has real benefits to, again, including as many sources of emissions under the cap to ensure that you've really cast the net as widely as possible to find, for so that market can find all the low-cost emission reductions available to it. And in Oregon, that really means the program should cover, at the least, emissions from the transportation and electricity sectors. Those are, of course, Oregon's two largest sectors, emissions-wise. And then What we discovered is that setting that cap, aligning that cap with the trajectory of Oregon's greenhouse gas reduction goals is also really important, most obviously to meeting those goals, but also that happens not coincidentally to be at about the level the cap would need to be set to be compatible to link with those jurisdictions I already mentioned, as those jurisdictions have designed their programs to achieve very similar goals that those jurisdictions have as the goals we have here in Oregon. Last slide here. A few more preliminary findings. We don't yet have the results back from our consultant on the macroeconomic effects, unfortunately, so I cannot present on those. Otherwise, I'm sure I'd have at least a slide to share on that. But what I can say is that from the literature review that we conducted, as well as the literature review that our consultant provided us, what's very clear in literature is that the macroeconomic modeling that's been done many different places in different ways for programs like this is that the overall, like, jurisdictional economic effects tend to be very modest, but they're not spread evenly across that economy, but they are disproportionately borne by certain types of businesses. And probably intuitively, those are the businesses that are most reliant on carbon-intensive sources of energy. So as I've already covered, there are some real considerations for mitigating how those disproportionate economic effects are borne by certain parts of the economy. We also discovered that there are some real important reasons to use different techniques for distributing those allowances into the marketplace, directly allocating allowances to certain business types that I've already mentioned to reduce that or minimize that a leakage effect can be, that's a really important mechanism that a program like this offers to minimizing leakage, but yet still maintaining that price incentive for those businesses to invest in emission reduction technologies. Whereas an auction may be the most equitable and efficient mechanism for distributing allowances to the fuel supply or fossil fuel sector. And then finally, there's a technique referred to as consignment that may be appropriate for portions of the program that are regulated by the Public Utility Commission that can oversee the revenue that is generated by this this approach. And it works basically by directly providing the allowances to natural gas or electric utilities, but requiring that those utilities turn those allowances over to the auction for sale, and then the PUC can oversee that revenue to distribute it to particular types of ratepayers or evenly across the ratepayers, however you, the program. There's a lot of flexibility there to design the program in any number of ways to use that revenue, but the importance is that you have the PUC there to oversee the disbursement of that revenue. It's also important to note that any of the revenue generated by this program that is coming from transportation fuel suppliers is likely subject to the constitutional restriction here in Oregon that revenue be used to invest in the maintenance and upgrades to transportation infrastructure. And then finally, we found that that a program like this, if deliberately designed to do so, can complement policies like a renewable portfolio standard or a clean fuels program. There's some important design considerations to ensure that there is a complementary interaction there, not just simply a duplication or even a conflicting interaction. But overall, those policies that we have here already, the renewable portfolio standard and the low carbon fuel standard, actually provide a really important market transformational signal to those sectors that those sectors need to invest in the apparatus to deliver lower carbon energy, either electricity or transportation fuels. That transformational signal to those markets should prove very important to maintaining a durable and low-cost price signal from a cap-and-trade program like this. So those are the preliminary findings. There's a link there to the study if you guys are interested in reading through all 60 pages or just the first 8 to 12 in the introduction. Highly recommend it. And with that, I'll close for questions.
Thank you very much. And the final report will be due in February?
That's right.
The full report. Okay, wonderful. Questions for Colin? Yes, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The transformational signal or phrase. The question when I was looking at the impact of this proposal as compared to the low carbon fuel standard
in some of the reading I was doing in anticipation of a discussion of how much our gasoline prices might go up if we had all of those costs imposed upon drivers in Oregon. Are you, you're suggesting, I was looking at your report at the last page where you actually addressed this issue, and it seems to me it's not quite as sanguine as you are, or sanguine as you are about this this problem. So were you suggesting that the higher price fuel, I think this is what you mean by, quote, transformational signal, that higher price fuel, even if you double it by virtue of these programs, that's a transformational signal, which means people need to go get an electric car. Is that what you're telling us, this report tells us? Because I don't see a number in here. I just see go to the highest point you can in the distribution system and make it less regulatorily burdensome, but nonetheless price goes up. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Baker Peterson, Representative Benz, I am saying yes, that the price, this program would likely add additional cost to carbon-intensive fuels like gasoline and diesel, but that the more prescriptive signal of a low carbon fuel standard that more specifically tells that sector that the infrastructure and apparatus needed to deliver alternative fuels that have low or no carbon in them, that more prescriptive signal over the long run helps moderate the otherwise more volatile price that a market like this could produce, because this market it's like a continuously solving equation, constantly seeking out the lowest cost emission reduction available to it in the broader marketplace, and doesn't necessarily send that more prescriptive signal. So the market, absent of that market transformational signal, could encounter more bumps along the road, essentially, in that price. But by having that more, again, prescriptive direction to the transportation fuel supply sector, that those lower carbon fuels need to be delivered in increasing amounts, helps moderate the long-term price signal from a program like this.
The follow-up. What you said is the price is going to go up. That's what you said, and that's what the report says. It doesn't say how much.
Yes.
So what we do is we take refuge in this. It's going to go up. It's going to go down. But the magic of the market system is going to save us. That's what we're hearing.
Chair Baker-Peterson, Representative Benz, the what the market brings is the ability to find those lowest cost emission reductions, and the fact that it is agnostic as to where they come from, so long as they're coming from sources that are covered by the program. So it is, in theory, supposed to provide the lowest cost emission reductions, as well as providing assurance that overall emissions do not exceed the limit imposed by the program.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Representative Holm.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for this work. And I've found the draft on your website, and I'll be reading through it. And I know it's late in the game to suggest new topics, but I'm going to say this in this forum because I worry that in the conversation about cap-and-trade system that we inadvertently leave out both the impacts and benefits, potentially, of a system to both forestry and agriculture. And I can see by looking at your charge in the legislation that that wasn't explicitly called out. And I imagine it's too late to include that kind of thing in this report. But as we move forward, I don't think we have a complete discussion about a cap-and-trade system without addressing those two sectors in both how they will be impacted by emission reduction requirements and by how they might be benefited by linking up to other credit systems that are existing out there. So as we move forward in this work, I'd like to see more discussion about those two sectors.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions, please. Part of your findings talk about the benefits of joining larger markets and trading, I think, is what you talked about, credits and so forth. The voters of Washington voted down a carbon tax. Does that enter into your modeling as you go forth and any report about appetites for voters for engaging in this kind of system and so forth? Does it change the availability of trading partners, and might that impact the feasibility of what you're proposing to us?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, it didn't explicitly factor into our assessment of how this program would work. Washington does not have a program that, like what we looked at here, for us to link to, certainly. And that carbon tax proposal that you mentioned, it also would not have formed a system that we could link to as well.
Right. And if I can add just a finer point to that, if you really talk about linking to other jurisdictions, largely what you're talking about in terms of a mechanism to price carbon is a cap and trade mechanism. So when we looked at this study and the charge that we had, which was if Oregon were to, the legislature were to adopt some type of policy to price carbon, how best might that be designed by looking at what other jurisdictions had done, what the literature says, and being able to do some economic modeling. It was our estimation that linkage offers a lot of the benefits that Colin talks about by creating a broader market so that those regulated entities who have to buy the allowances can look in at as many different places as possible and seek as many trades as they can to find that lowest cost option. And to do that, you have to link through a cap and trade mechanism.
You also, in your report, cover as many emission sources as possible. You listed transportation and some of the difficulties there, but you also list electricity. And we just had a report on Senate Bill 1547, which I think puts Oregon on a glide path to be in a pretty good position regarding emissions and greenhouse gas emissions and so forth. Why would we want to make the ratepayers pay twice?
Chair Megan Peterson, Representative Johnson.
The benefit of that, I guess, is what I'm looking for.
Right, right. Well, first of all, to the point about ratepayers paying twice, this is a good example of one of the ways that this program would need to be deliberately designed to complement those existing policies that put us on that glide path you referenced. And one of the ways you can do that is through the allocation of allowances by not making utility ratepayers pay for some or all of those allowances that the utility requires. By still covering the utility has the price incentive to go to reduce emissions, but the ratepayers are not necessarily on the hook to pay for those allowances, depending on how you design the system. And that was certainly one of the areas that we looked into in depth with programs in California and in Quebec, as well as talking with our own utilities here about how could this program be designed. Essentially, if you think of that glide path as a line or a trajectory that the emissions from these utilities are on, if they're already paying down to that line through the RPS and the existing other policies we have, how does a program like this be designed not to make them also pay up to that line as well, so they're not paying down and up to it at the same time? And I think there are ways that this program could be designed to not make them pay twice. But again, that would have to be a deliberate design element of the program design.
And Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, if I can add one thing, when we were charged with looking at this, and I think anybody studying this issue has to give some thought to, is a program like a cap and trade to address climate change and you know, try to reduce greenhouse gases is a multi-decade strategy. When you think about how deep the reductions in greenhouses have to be in, say, 2050 to meet the statutory goals, you have to think about broadly covering the economy to achieve those kind of reductions. So you look again at our largest sectors of transportation and you know, power, energy, and I think you realize that to achieve those kind of reductions over that length of time, it has to be a broadly based policy.
If I may, Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, just add to my response. I realize I've forgotten one important element here in this area, is that the policy like this, as I already mentioned, provides a certain level of assurance that emissions are reduced to a certain amount. And the policies we have in place don't strictly mandate a particular amount of emissions. They work differently than that. So a policy like this is often referred to as a backstop, providing a backstop should those policies we already have in place not deliver on the anticipated amount of emission reductions. This policy would essentially step in and provide the added amount of reductions to maintain that glide path.
Okay. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was glad to hear you mention, reference the California-Quebec. I guess it's a partnership in that sense. And they've been doing it a while, and we had an opportunity in this committee not too long ago to have them come up and talk about that. And I'm just wondering, since they have now changed the guard down there in California to a new group of Quebecans, or whatever you call them, Canadians, are you still in contact with them? Have you talked to them how they're doing now? Because from what I understand, the amount of money they've raised is huge. And there are several different permutations of this kind of thing, and some are revenue neutral and some are, you know, different. But have you considered all the different ways that it could be implemented?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Boone, we looked at a number of options that we lay out in the report. We did specifically narrow the scope of the study to looking at a program modeled after what's there in California and Quebec. And my understanding with discussions with folks in those programs is that they are proceeding as planned. There are not any major changes that I'm aware of that we would anticipate. I know the California system in particular is looking out at where that program goes from between 2020 and 2030, and it looks one of the proposals, and I think that kind of the default proposal, if that's the right way to characterize it, would maintain the system, although with the cap trajectory continuing to decline along with California's goals, but it would maintain the program as it currently exists throughout that next decade. And so that's what we are. That's the best indication, I guess, we have of where those programs are going in the more longer term.
Just a quick follow-up. I know you're busy waiting for that. I just wondered if you have any idea how much we might raise here in Oregon.
Chair Vega Peter.
Maybe you didn't go that far. I don't know.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Boone. We have not looked at that. We have not modeled it. I think if you look at the minimum price that allowances are selling for in the linked systems between California and Quebec, which is about $13 a ton, it's reasonable to assume that we're talking about perhaps a couple hundred million dollars generated each year. But that is obviously very rough, if I could think of additional words to hedge my answer, I'd probably throw those in.
Thank you.
So noted. All right. Representative Holby.
Just to go back for a second on the clean fuels program. Where is that at with the implementation? I've gotten emails over time about, you know, the huge increase in cost per gallon that this has already caused, this program. Do you have information about that? Well, what is the actual cost today for the clean fuels program per gallon?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, we do have an estimate. It's a bit dated, from 2014, that estimates where there will be retail price impacts. And DEQ has always been on the record that there would be retail gas impacts associated with clean fuels.
I'm aware of that estimate.
Right.
I'm just curious if you have any update to that.
No, and we are in the process of getting a new assessment of the availability of alternative fuels. I think that's really going to talk about the availability of alternative fuels and give some idea of if those availability is there to meet what we think would be the demand and the obligations of the importers of fuel into Oregon, which is the regulated party for clean fuels. So we are in the process of looking at that. It's still probably at least a few weeks to a couple months away. I'm not sure of the exact timeline before we would have that information. But what that would really tell you is and a consultant would be looking at, under multiple scenarios, making different assumptions about the future, whether there were cleaner fuels available to meet the obligations under, and that would be at commercially available prices to meet the obligations of the Clean Fuels Program. So that's sort of the best estimate that we have coming. It doesn't really speak to your question about retail price impacts, which I know and understand is the big issue and the concern for many. But we don't have an updated information on that specific issue.
Thank you. Very quickly, yes.
One follow-up related to Representative Benz's question for our PUC friends earlier. Will your final report also include a fiscal estimate on what this will cost either DEQ or the state to administer should a program like this be put into place?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, it will not include a fiscal.
Right. And just to be clear, Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, the direction to us, as we understood it, was give us the best your best analysis of the existing literature and what other jurisdictions are doing about designing a carbon pricing mechanism for Oregon, and then we specifically looked at cap and trade. So the actual design features are somewhat open and subject to legislative debate, and it would only be when we had a bill and we had sort of that clarity about what the design choices were and actual language to look at that we could probably give you a real fiscal impact in the sense that I think you're asking. We will have some modeling around the effect of a cap and trade, a generic sort of hypothetical cap and trade program on Oregon's economy, but that's at a pretty macro level.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you both very much for this report. I'm sure this is something that will come up again, but this is a good place to start, and we look forward to the final report in February.
Thank you.
So the last informational hearing we're going to have is going to be on the review of expiring energy tax credits. We have Chris Elenak from Legislative Revenue Office here to talk about this. And so for those of you who have been on the committee for a while, you know that tax credits expire, are set up to sunset every 6 years based on legislation that was passed about three or four sessions ago, or terms ago. And they're grouped by topic. So the topic, the group that's up for expiration for sunset this next cycle at the end of 2017 are all of the energy tax credits. And so they'll come to the policy committee first for consideration of the policy means, and then they'll move forward to the tax credit committee where they'll decide based on kind of revenue issues whether or not those should be go forward or not. And this is really not to delve deeply into the merits of different tax credits. It's really to give an overview of what's out there, what do they do, and kind of give you some background information as you start in 2017 to take a look at those. I know that there's already been some discussion about these in our committee that we're on the ODO, the Department of Energy Oversight Committee, as well as the governor has come out with some recommendations on tax credits. So this is just to help inform the conversation that's already happening. And Chris, it's great to have you here. I kind of invited you because I missed you from the Revenue Committee. So it was my prerogative in my last meeting. So take it away.
We miss you on the Revenue Committee as well. So good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Elenak, Legislative Revenue Office. And to that point, I just have a few slides that are going to touch on the five credits, and basically I just have a couple of bullet points of what the credit is, then a slide about the tax, data from tax returns, and then a policy purpose statement, or at least information that we have on that, which has been a focus of the policy committees in the past, at least the way that leadership has decided the process will work. There's no guarantee it'll be the same, but that's kind of what I'm the perspective I'm working from. So I think everybody is familiar with these credits, but they are the residential energy tax credit. There's a conservation tax credit, a renewables tax credit, a transportation tax credit, and a biomass tax credit. So the first one of these, the RETC, was created in 1977, and it has been regularly modified over the years. It's been tweaked one way or another in many of the sessions in between. At its core, the credit is either 50% of the cost of the device up to $1,500, or some of them are a certain rate per first year energy yield up to $6,000. For those tax credits that are $6,000, they are taken over 4 years so that no more than $1,500 is claimed in any 1 year. And the number of devices is extensive, but looking at the data in terms of where most of the revenue impact comes from, it's solar electric systems, photovoltaic, high energy heat pumps, high efficiency furnaces, and then some of the other examples are fuel cells, duct sealing, and wood pellet stoves. This is by no means an exhaustive list of the devices that are eligible. Part of the tax credit report that the chair referred to is piecing together the goal is an evaluation of the tax credits, but the first step in evaluation is having a clear purpose statement for the tax credit, because that's what defines the constructs for the evaluation that leads to the metrics. So in digging through the history of the tax credits, it's not always clear what the purpose is. In many respects, on the one hand, it seems kind of obvious. You have a tax credit to incent a certain kind of behavior, so that's what the policy is. But without a clear statement, there can be debate about the necessary metrics to evaluate that. So part of this process is going through and working with the committees, and a lot of the work that the policy committees do, as one would guess, is come up with a policy purpose statement. So the initial debate back in the late 70s was basically moving away from fossil fuels, I think, as most people know. And then in 2015, Otto testified to this committee, and part of what, in their testimony, they indicated that the purpose was to promote energy savings or energy displacement and market transformation without a lot of elaboration on exactly what that means. So collectively, they seem to be the tax credit seems to have the goal of developing a market for non-conventional energy use within homes. So this is kind of the residential side. I don't think I'm going too far out on a limb on that, but it'll be up for the next legislature to fine-tune that policy. So looking at tax returns for the past 10 years or so, we can see the pattern of the tax credits. And by and large, it's about $12 million a year in the tax credits that get used. For those not familiar with tax return data, I have a claim number and a used number. The claim number, the red dash, is the amount that taxpayers write down on their tax returns. The blue is the amount that gets used to offset their liability. Some taxpayers have more tax credits than they have liability, and those tax credits can then be carried forward into subsequent years. One thing we can see here is the drop in 2012 is a result of the policy changes that were enacted in 2011. A big change was the appliances. Many of the appliances were no longer eligible for the credit. The policy became more focused on the highest efficient appliances. And the bottom number there, you've seen the number of claimants where it fell from about 50,000 down to about 14,000. And it's been climbing over the past couple of years. So that's just high level view of the cost and the number of claimants. So moving on to the non-residential tax credits, these were established as separate credits in 2011. So starting from that point moving forward, we have the conservation tax credit, which is a 35% tax credit for eligible capital investments that conserve energy. The tax credit structure is 35% is claimed over 5 years, so that there's 10% in each of the first 2 years and 5% in the subsequent 3 years. So that's the 35%. And the program has a biennial tax credit cap of $28 million. The renewable energy is an auction tax credit. It's one of two or three auction tax credits that the state has, and that goes to fund a grant program for renewable energy projects. And the biennial tax credit cap for there is about $3 million, so $1.5 million get auctioned off each year. The transportation tax credit is a 35% tax credit, just like the conservation, and it focuses on infrastructure and fleet vehicles. So not individual vehicles, so if you have a fleet or the refueling stations is what this tax credit focuses on now. And it has a biennial tax credit cap of $20 million, and $3 million of that had been partitioned off for an auction tax credit where the proceeds went to it's an alternative vehicle fueling fund. Get that backwards. So the policy purpose statements, and given that these were modified in 2011, these are taken from other ODO testimony in front of the committee from last session. And again, I don't think they're very controversial. The conservation to promote energy savings and market transformation, renewables to invest in renewable energy development, and transportation to promote cleaner transportation fuels and diversity in the fuel market. That's also been argued for on kind of the give and take of how this market might work. You can sell the alternative fuel vehicles, but there needs to be the infrastructure in place to refuel them if they're going to get widespread acceptance. So earlier on, we had a tax credit for the vehicles that was sunset, and the focus in recent years has been on the infrastructure, the refueling of those, with the addition of the fleet vehicles recently. The tax credits claimed here have been off to a slow start, if you will, at least compared to the program caps, where conservation is in 2014 got up to about 1.5 million claimed, renewables 1.6, and then transportation was just about $200,000. So in net, only about $3 million in tax credits were claimed in tax year 2014. But one of the issues that I think people are familiar with are a number of unsold tax credits that are out there, and that's what this bottom table is here. So there are a total of about $40 million in tax credits that were awarded and certified, but they are owned by either businesses or governments or nonprofits who can't use the tax credit, and they're looking to sell them. So that while the impact on the tax return so far has been fairly minimal, there is this block of tax credits that are out there dealing with some policy issues. So moving to the biomass tax credit, it was created in 2007. It's limited to material sourced in Oregon, and that material must be used as a biofuel or to produce biofuels in Oregon. And there are about 10 different materials that are eligible for a tax credit, and the rates vary by the type of material. The policy purpose statement here, again, I'm going to go back to ODO testimony in front of this, this was in front of the Revenue Committee in 2015, basically to move away from oil and to stimulate value-added utilization of material that otherwise would basically go to waste. And there have been some of the documentation refers to economic development opportunities for rural parts of the state. And in the short session in 2016, the biomass manure tax credit was extended and modified. The rate was reduced and that was extended. And the policy argument for that was to increase the capital investment in manure digesters. So one of the things about the purpose statements is trying to figure out if every type of biomass has the same policy purpose. So that would be something for the committee to consider as they move forward. And here's the history from tax returns for the credit. It peaked at about $8 million in 2010, and it's starting to increase again in 2013 and 2014. But on average, we're talking about $6 million or so a year in tax credits here. Additional information I have here is from certification data. This is from the Department of Energy. I put up here just 2010 and 2014 to show the change in the magnitude of which types of material. So the table here shows the tax credit rate per type of biomass. And in 2010 and 2014, about $5.7 million in tax credits were certified. In 2010, most of that was woody biomass. And then by 2014, most of it is the manure biomass that's taking up the bulk of that tax credit. And in between there, as I think people know, the woody biomass tax credit was cut in half, going from a wet ton to a dry ton. So the last slide I have here is just kind of a high level. When I talk to committees about this process, I get a lot of questions about detail and how to move forward. And the key thing, at least so far, has been to try and focus a policy for any tax credit that gets created or extended. And I understand the situation for these tax credits right now, but to the extent the committee wants to extend one or create one, as tight a policy purpose as you can come up with really facilitates an eventual evaluation, lays the groundwork for evaluating that tax credit down the road. The legislature has been moving toward this policy of really trying to understand if the money being spent on these is most of it's going to the free rider problem, or if it's really, if the state's really getting its bang for the buck. So the focus policy really helps there. And then thinking about data collection in terms of metrics as the policy gets in place, and requirements of who would collect the data and where that data would be housed and how that gets handled. And now we get into potential costs. You get into fiscal situations where somebody needs to be tracking that. But if the ultimate goal is evaluation, we hear it time and time again, and I'm sure members get fatigued by the, well, we don't have any data. We need some data. It's kind of a common refrain. So as these tax credits are up for review or even creation, just thinking about that can go a long way to better evaluations down the road. Dynamic policy adjustments I threw in here because a couple of the energy credits the Department of Energy had been given some rulemaking authority to modify the tax credit incentive rates in between sessions. And so there's a give and take there between the branches of government and what the proper rates will be. But energy was given some authority to modify the incentive rates as market conditions warrant. So that's something to keep in the back of your mind. There are a lot that I'm just touching on it there. There's a lot behind that, but it's something to be considered. And then context of other established policies. Incentive stacking gets referred to a lot, and that's basically if there are multiple state tax credits or state tax credits and federal tax credits, or if there are other direct incentives that the state offers through the Energy Trust in this case, or other possible ways that a taxpayer might benefit on the tax side. Just being aware of those and understanding how the policy fits in with that larger landscape. I'm listing these off as if they're trivial to do, but they're not. And the last one is transferability. This is a big issue on whether the tax credits can be sold, transferred, and how they can be sold, and at what price. And there's a lot of strong feelings about the topic one way or the other. And there's a lot of nuance there about whether the state should engage in this at all. But one of the core aspects of tax credits is they will only benefit taxpayers who have a tax liability, and that may or may not be a population that overlaps to a great extent with the targeted population, if you will. So you have the private sector are the ones that have a tax liability, and they could benefit from tax credits. The nonprofit and other entities don't have a tax liability, so they can't benefit directly from these unless they can be sold. And again, these are you can probably spend a couple hours on each one of these issues and maybe get somewhere. But that's really a very fast, high-level introduction to the excitement you have to look forward to next session.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Representative Polvey.
Thanks for being here, Chris. And I'm curious, as you were going through those tax credits, many of them have caps in place and some of them don't. Didn't see any delineation of why we cap some and why we don't cap others. Because I look at the trajectory of things that have happened in the past, and without some sort of at least eyeball on how big they're getting and how quickly we get into some fiscal issues that we weren't planning on.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Polvey. A couple things play into that. In terms of a cap, for a cap to work, the process needs to almost necessarily have a certification up front. It would be largely unworkable to have a cap that would be at the back end and show up on the tax returns, because now you've created some really perverse incentives within the CPA community about racing to get their tax returns in to take advantage of a tax credit. So step one is if a program has a cap, there needs to be a certification process. So most of these tax credits here do have a certification process. And for the administrating agency, that's how they can manage their workload. Some of the other tax credits may not have a program cap. They might have a taxpayer cap. So there are different kinds of caps that exist. I'm kind of thinking about all of the tax credits that are in place. And the taxpayer cap is a different way. It's not as strict as the program cap, because that's a hard line. But the individual taxpayer cap is a way to kind of get there. And then other tax credits that don't have a cap, largely there's forces just haven't aligned to get that in place, or there have been technical difficulties, administrative logistical issues about how that cap would be in place. The biomass tax credit in my time here has always been talked about as putting a cap on it, but there have been arguments for and against that. And today there isn't a program cap. And then some of the caps are meant to tightly control the use of the tax credit, and then some of them are almost a fail-safe. We've had tax credits where the cap is much higher than the expected use of the tax credit, and that use of a cap is really a fail-safe, so we don't have the repeat of some bad experiences in the past. Other caps will be right at or below the actual demand level, where we know we're going to hit that cap over time.
So on the program cap, where you were articulating the race to get your tax credit before the cap is reached, are there caps that adjust based on the number of mm-hmm. tax credits claimed? Therefore, the size of the tax credit would fluctuate based on the overall size of the cap.
Yes, and I'm trying to think of an example, and I don't know if I'm merging other programs, but even if there isn't, it conceptually can be done. If you have a tax credit that has an annual cap of $10 million, it can be administered a couple of different ways. It could be the first 10 million claimants in the door, or there could be a filing deadline for certification, and at the end of the day, if, say, $12 million, there's a $12 million demand for it, everybody can be proportioned down to $10 million.
And do we have a follow-up? And do we have a tax credit like that anywhere else?
I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but I need to go back and see if we had one that maybe expired. Or I might be thinking of other states that have that similar process.
Thanks.
But I can't think of an example right now.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Chris, very much.
Sure.
That concludes our committee meeting for today. So I just wanted to thank you all for being such a wonderful committee. I have honestly can say that I've learned something in every single meeting that we've had. This is such an interesting set of issues that come before us, and I've really enjoyed working with all of you on a variety of things, from coastal issues to energy issues to climate issues. And Beth, I just have to say, I would not have been able to do this without you, so thank you so much for all of your help. And it's just been a pleasure. So I'll miss you guys a lot, but I will see you. I'll be back here next session. So with that, the committee is adjourned.
All right.
The committee is adjourned.